This is an Enterprise Times podcast sponsored by Unit 4. My name is Ian Murphy, and today I'm talking to Lisa Dodman, Chief People Officer at Unit 4. We're going to be talking about the challenges of diversity. Lisa, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, sure. My name is Lisa Dodman. I am Chief People Officer for Unit 4.
What is a Chief People Officer?
It would also be known as a Chief HR Officer, or many years ago, a Chief Personnel Officer. Essentially, I'm responsible for all of our people strategies and our people agenda for Unit 4 globally.
Diversity is a complicated problem for a lot of organisations, despite it being at the front of the HR agenda for the last 3, 4, 5 years. Where do companies start?
The first really important thing is to have a diversity, equity and inclusion roadmap, a plan, a direction of where you're going to go. And it could involve many different things, from the way you interact with your organisation. We have employee resource groups that span many different areas of diversity. We have a women's network. We have an LGBTQ community. Having that roadmap is really important. And also filtering into that events that take place during the year, whether it's about International Women's Day, whether it's about Black Lives Matter. We have a reflection day every year that we give to our employees at the same time each year to go and just reflect on things that are important to them, whether in their family, in their community. And diversity, equity and inclusion wraps through all of that. And also includes the training you would give to your employees. We do unconscious bias training, we do diversity training for our employees, and we make sure our leaders are equipped to deal with the many different things that having a focus on diversity, equity and inclusion would bring.
How do you get buy-in across a large organisation? Because there will be people who, for some reason, don't necessarily buy into the wider agenda.
Any employer would struggle to say they have everybody running in the same direction because everybody is entitled to their own view. For us, it's about educating as much as possible, making sure people understand that they have a voice, but also ensuring people recognise that not everybody is going to have the same opinion as each other. One of the things that talks to that, which has been very relevant certainly over the last year, is that regardless of your beliefs, your views, we've seen so much vulnerability shown. I think for every employer, for every person, listening more is an important part of how businesses should operate moving forward, so that there's no one view of the world. Everybody has a voice and not everyone will have the same opinion. And that's okay, as long as we respect everyone. Everyone needs to have a sense of belonging.
How much pressure is there from customers? If we look at the wider society, there's now an expectation on companies, and expectations can be unrealistic.
We have lots of public sector customers around the world, and we're seeing a strong bias towards social value. All of the customer engagements we now do, particularly in our public sector environments, speaks to many different aspects of diversity. They're looking for not only what your environmental commitments are, your CSR strategy, but they're also looking at how you address diversity within your organisation. Customer awareness has increased. Events of the last year, both the pandemic, but also all the other political, social and environmental events that happened around the world have also played a part in how companies and customers view things.
How do you empower staff to talk? Because for a lot of them, when they talk about things, they feel vulnerable. From my perspective, one of the reasons I left the Royal Marines was my alcoholism. It's beginning to be a subject that people will talk about a little bit more openly, but it still leaves people unsure of themselves. When you look at other areas of diversity, there's a lot more reason that people have kept themselves closed off and hidden. Are you finding it easy to encourage staff to feel empowered and to come out of themselves and be open?
Yes. I don't think any company could ever say we tick every single box of making it perfectly easy for people. As we hire more people from the younger generation who don't have generally any kind of biases, they want to be who they want to be, and they're proud to be able to speak. They've grown up in environments where that's probably more common for vulnerabilities to be shown and accepted. We start to see a push to share a bit more. So we encourage, we have a people spotlight that we issue every month, and that focuses on various different initiatives. We do spotlights on our diversity, equity and inclusion roadmap, our LGBTQ community, our women's network feature, and many other aspects that we try to tackle head on as a subject. Does that mean everybody would come forward? Maybe not, but we encourage people. We have a thing called Inspiration for You, which is a podcast series by our people, for our people. We've had various topics discussed. I did a piece on diversity where I spoke about being bullied when I was younger and how that affected the way I made decisions in my life, because bullying either breaks you or makes you stronger. It's important that people feel safe, to your point, that vulnerability. We've tried very hard to give people that room to be who they want to be. We are very much moving towards freedom of choice in our workspace environment, in our people initiatives. Choose who you want to be. Choose how far you want to go with your career. You drive it. You drive the direction. And be proud of who you are.
If we go back 20, 30 years, organisations had social clubs, sports clubs for the bigger companies. Lots of little groups came along. That all went by the wayside as companies became more of a transactional relationship with their staff rather than the family. Are you finding that that is beginning to change? And has lockdown had any benefit within that?
Lockdown has certainly played a part. Not necessarily in a positive way, because much of our workforce, the very ability to connect on a face-to-face basis and be social and share and learn from the energy around us has been affected. Obviously, people have been in lockdown. They've been parent, teacher, employee. The very nature of what you would get with social clubs, where it's constant interaction and activities changed, that philosophy, even if it's not in a social club format, ground to a halt the minute the lockdowns went in place. We do encourage our teams to get together, to share experiences, to pre-COVID doing activities together. This last year obviously changed that. We typically as an organisation do a global sports event every year where we bring everybody together to one location and we split them in teams, normally in countries, and they do lots of different events. We couldn't do that last year. We did a celebration event at Christmas, recognising that we couldn't get people together face to face. So we did a virtual event, which was a series of games. We sent everybody a gift pack in advance. So they had cocktail making, they could build a paper tree, and then we had an online games event to try and bring multiple teams that wouldn't normally interact together. So we very much encourage this interacting across the teams. To your point, has it been affected by the last year in the pandemic? Yes, that social connection has. Has the world of social clubs changed? Yes. In some countries, we've been doing virtual escape rooms. The world of how you interact socially has changed. I hope that post-pandemic we'll recover some of that back to face-to-face interaction and connection, because it's really, really important.
I love that idea of virtual escape rooms. I mean, how do you begin to set that up?
Well, I imagine a lot of people feel like they're in a permanent, locked-in, non-get-out escape room.
If we look at the workplace, one of the advantages it had for some people, perhaps those suffering abuse at home, was it was an opportunity to get out, get away, have that engagement with other people where you could, if not talk about it, at least feel safe. As we go back to the world of part office, part hybrid, how do we begin to build safe spaces again inside offices?
It's an interesting point. Like many companies, we've experienced people in that situation as well, and we've continued to create a safe haven during lockdowns when I think it exacerbated some of the challenging situations that people face. as we move forward as a business, we are moving more towards a freedom of choice in environment. We will have less fixed offices, but we'll have hub structures where customers, partners, employees can collaborate. And it's important in those environments that there's opportunity to interact, but also have thinking space. The safety and well-being of our employees is critical to us, whether it's seen or unseen. It's important that we enable people to feel safe. One of our values is people first, and we absolutely stand firmly behind that value.
How does diversity change recruitment? If we go back 10, 15 years, HR controlled a lot of recruitment, often based on a CV. You either had a degree or you didn't have a degree. And then there was a series of interviews. Today, there are an awful lot more people beginning to come back into the marketplace who've learned at home or who would prefer not to go to university, but instead go and get some other form of training. But with that comes the challenge, and again, the perception of, are you creating a fully inclusive for everybody environment? What does that mean for you as a chief people officer?
You're absolutely right. I remember working for an ex-Marconi company, and if you didn't have a degree, you didn't get a job. Automatically, you then take out half of the nation who could possibly apply. It was the dumb thing. If you didn't tick the criteria fully, you just didn't get a job. In the software industry of the past, STEM qualifications have always been very, very important. But I think what we're recognising, and it's not just us as an employer, but every employer, look at the environment we've just been in. We've hired 240 people in lockdown who've never even been in a face-to-face interview, who've not actually had to sit in a room with a panel or any of that. They've had to learn different social interaction skills by the very nature that they've never physically met the people that they're now engaging with on a regular basis. For us, because we're creating this environment of self-driving careers, choose your direction, we're also trying to remove these barriers of the rule book says you can only have this job if you've got this qualification. Career opportunities, in my view, it's about how driven are you? How focused are you? How do you embrace the opportunities that stand in front of you? Do you see change as a negative? Do you see it as something that can help you progress? A CV is not going to show you how someone copes implementing software on a customer site. One of the things that we did just before the lockdown hit, we hired a number of graduates who came in as professional services graduates. So they'd never deployed software for the customer. They came from all different experiences. But the important thing was, you can't teach someone a degree, any qualification doesn't teach someone how to interact with a customer. It doesn't teach them empathy. It doesn't teach them the work ethic that is customer first. No qualification can give them that. And that's a really important part of what the customer sees. Have we given them the best experience possible? No qualification is going to tick that box.
How do you begin to deal with people who don't interview well? I think about several of my neurodiverse friends, and interviews are a nightmare for them. I personally have always hated the idea of doing interviews. I've hated the idea of doing exams, professional exams, as I've gone through my career. And there are quite a large degree of people who are beginning to fit into that category. How do we change that interview process to be friendlier?
It's a good point that you raise, because I know myself, I don't necessarily perform well in interviews. And if you're someone that suffers from anxiety, and my daughter suffers from anxiety and panic attacks, it's the worst thing you could possibly ask that person to do. Applying your diversity approach across all aspects of hire to retire in anything you do is really, really important. Do I think we're at the end of the journey and we've ticked all the boxes? No. There's so many unknowns in the whole spectrum of diversity that I think it would be impossible for any employer to tick every single box completely. But I do think it's time for employers to recognise that diversity comes in all shapes, sizes, different ways of working, different approaches. Not everybody can show the best of them in a classic interview process. All employers will have to think about how they modify not only their hiring approaches, but their onboarding approaches as well. If you look at the pandemic, we've had to make everything virtual. And that's, again, not necessarily getting the best out of people, because being on video is not something everybody is comfortable with. Being open to the fact that not everybody may be able to cope with the classic, this is the way we've always done things, is important when you think about diversity within your recruiting strategy.
How did you get the education into yourselves? I did an interview with Emily Switek from the National Autism Society a few years ago. And one of the things she said to me is, a challenge is when somebody says to her, I want your best job and I want it by Friday. To her, they're two completely separate goals. Well, which one do you want? Do you want my best? Do you want it by Friday? It was a phrase that I've used myself many times, and it never dawned on me that it can actually be an exclusionary phrase. When you're talking to your own teams, how do you change that language? How do you begin to better understand the people that you're interviewing?
It is totally obvious when you say it. You want my best, but you want it within the next few days. Well, I'm clearly not necessarily going to be able to deliver my best, which is obvious when you think about it. But when you're in that situation and people are under pressure, it probably isn't obvious to that person. One of the things I would hope that employers embrace more than anything else is allowing people the room to be who they are, so that they have the confidence to step up and say, actually, you've asked me for my best, but by Friday, I need to have that safe environment that I can say, actually, no, if you want my best, it's going to be another week, or it's going to be 5 days instead of 3 days, because you're compromising my ability to do the very best showcase of myself if you're putting me into these pressure situations. Educating our leaders, whether it's in recruitment or in any aspect of our employment of our people, needs to be part of the step of change. It's very easy to make those comments you've just made. Everything is urgent. Everything has to be now, but not giving the person the freedom to challenge. I sometimes find myself saying, okay, you want this and you want this. Tell me which is the most important. And what's the realistic timescale? Because if you want all of this, it's going to take this long. I think people have to feel they have a voice.
It's interesting, earlier you were talking about bringing younger people into the workplace who seem much more self-assured, much more willing to deal with things. Yet historically, they've often been the ones who've been unvoiced in an organisation. They're new to a role. They're seen as being subservient to people who've got much more experience and time served. How do you change not just their belief in themselves to make that challenge, but also your older colleagues to be able to let people talk to them?
One of the things that the pandemic has taught me is that crisis brings opportunity. Wherever you look on the spectrum of age, there is a challenge that people will face, whether it's not having a voice, not wanting things to change, not wanting people to just overlook them, being bold, being who they want to be. Is there a right way of working for everyone? No. And our job as an employer is to give people the freedom that they can fall and it's okay to make a mistake, or it's okay to be who they want to be. They may not have said things in the way that maybe you as a leader would like them to say it, or you would say it yourself, but giving people that freedom to speak up, to be a little bit different, push the boundaries and challenge. There are so many occasions in so many companies where people just follow the rules. Wouldn't it be nice sometimes if they just broke the rules and set the new path for those rules?
How does all this then play out in an ongoing career for people? We hear a lot of talk about glass ceilings. Equally, we've heard conversations about the use of quotas to break those glass ceilings. But either process creates points of friction. How do we eliminate friction by just promoting people based on who they are if they want to be promoted? But equally, a much more challenging one is continuing to reward somebody who's happy in their job but who might be pay banded, normally we'd expect to promote them to increase their pay. How do we change the rules to leave somebody who's really good where they are, but without penalising them?
Sometimes there can be assumptions made because a person doesn't want to progress. There's almost in the past a stigma attached. You could be absolutely excellent at what you do, and you might have done it for 5-10 years, but that doesn't mean that you're not bringing value. If you had 500 employees and all of them were pushing the boundaries, pushing the ceiling, wanting the next step yesterday, it creates a different issue for an organisation. You can never keep everybody happy, and you need that blend of people who are happy doing what they're doing a great job, but they're not aspiring to be a leader, they're not aspiring to be the next CEO, they're just happy being absolutely excellent at what they do and the guru that everybody goes to. I find it really helps if you can get them to mentor the individuals that are coming through the business. There's a lot that they can talk about in terms of history, in terms of experiences, in terms of their view on, I don't know, software development, for example. You have to learn the basics before you have to walk before you can run. Sometimes people can get ahead of themselves wanting the next step in a matter of months, and then they fall because they haven't really had the depth of experience. Development plans are really important. Learning from life is really, really, really important. You need to learn how a business operates. You need to learn how the mechanics of that role operate. I'm a firm believer, when I look at my career, I often explain it like buying a house or buying a car. Each year I look at what have I learned in the previous year, and it's a bit like buying a car. I didn't have this on the car previously. This is what I want next. Or buying a house. You didn't have a conservatory and now you want one in your next house. What are the building blocks that help you to get to the next stage in your career? Have a plan. It doesn't have to be a published plan. It could just be something that you think, in order for me to develop, whether in this company or in the next company, I need these ticks in the box. How am I going to get them? If I look back, leaving Unit 4 was always considered a bad thing. 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was always considered a bad thing. How can you let that person leave? But actually, if you've enabled that person to progress, and then ultimately they choose to leave because they get something more rewarding, more challenging, then it's the next part of the adventure for them. We keep them in our alumni, so they stay part of our wider network, but we also create opportunity for someone else to progress because they've left. This concept of just being focused on where do you want to get to, regardless of whether that's a hierarchical change, it could just be some other technology you want to learn, or all of the above should be acceptable in any organisation.
And what about the glass ceilings and quotas? How do we deal with that?
Don't have quotas. We don't work on quotas. We don't say we must have X number of people who excel and deliver at the highest level so that they become execs in the next year. We are firm believers in enabling people opportunity. We ran a learning festival at the start of this year, 3 weeks of personal and professional sessions that all of our employees could join. We had over 2,700 registrations for everyone to learn something that would help them develop, whether it was a personal thing they wanted to learn, a professional thing. So there were product demonstrations, there were presentation skills, career, growth mindset activities, because it's all about how you learn, how you want to learn, and how you use that learning.
Here's the bit where it gets tricky on every call. Three things that somebody listening to this can now take away and put into action in their organisation to improve their diversity and inclusion.
Okay, number one, develop a roadmap. Have a clear plan of what your organisation is going to drive that links to your values or your behaviours or your beliefs as an organisation. Having the roadmap is the first thing. Secondly, make sure that your diversity, equity and inclusion starts to become a normal part of your business, from hire to retire, that everything that you look at it through a lens of the whole experience for your employees, wherever they are, current or future. It's not a one-time thing. It's an evolving thing. You're not going to be perfect at everything, but the point is you've gone on the road of discovery and change. The third thing, when you've put your roadmap together, start to think of groups that you would set up that include your employee base to make sure they have a voice. Make sure that you don't just put the company's stamp on it. You have an all-inclusive, multi-directional view of what diversity, equity, and inclusion means. No two people will see things in exactly the same way. Being open to listening, being open to showing vulnerability, and enabling people to share their experiences is an important part of learning as a company. They will be my three things.
The one thing I hope out of this year we've just had is that people have started to understand a bit more about listening and vulnerabilities.
I hope so too. I think so many people have been through so many different things. My one big thing is it's okay to not be okay. We've seen so many challenges that our people have experienced, whether personally or professionally, whether directly or indirectly affected by COVID, or the ramifications that it brought in terms of how people coped with lockdown, in terms of how people coped with having children at home. It showcased the best and the worst in humanity throughout all of the pandemic, but it absolutely is a learning experience for all of us.
I hope so. Lisa, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you for your time.